Yuri strode into the vast chamber that housed the death cry. Brigid Baptiste and Dr. Djougashvili were hidden in the corridor, hoping their plan would work. There were 9 soldiers, another 8 scientists and their assistants, with no easy way to just sneak in and commandeer the weapon itself. They were outnumbered, and the soldiers would never trust Brigid without an affidavit from their leader, General Sergei, who was still lying unconscious on the floor of the interrogation room. Instead, she had come up with a different plan. Yuri looked uncomfortable as he hefted his Fedorov rifle, clearly a man unused to fighting.
What is it, comrade?
It's General Sergei. He gave me this rifle. The prisoner...
What? Slow down, man. You're not making any sense.
The red-headed woman, the counter-revolutionary, escaped. The general and his men are searching every office, and he says that you are to check the other corridor, the whole complex.
This is terrible. How did she escape?
She, I do not know. I was sent to warn you. You must move quickly while I am to check inside the death cry.
The soldier nodded curtly.
You hear that, comrades?
With that, the other soldiers followed the sentry out of the room and into the series of corridors that Brigid had first used to enter the complex, in the opposite direction to her current hiding place with Dr. Djougashvili. Only one soldier remained behind.
I will accompany you until the death cry.
Well, thank you, comrade.
Once the other sentries were out of sight, Yuri turned and jabbed the solid butt of the Fedorov into the man's gut. The soldier staggered backward, but Brigid could see that the blow wasn't hard enough to fell him. She was already running across the lightning bolt floor of the room, her legs pumping, wielding her own rifle like a club. As the soldier turned, Brigid smashed him across the jaw with the hard metal of the rifle. When she looked up, Brigid saw the look of horror on Yuri's face.
Keep moving. There's no time left for subtlety.
With Dr. Djougashvili leading the way with his rolling, limping walk, the three of them made their way to the scaffolding, leading to the giant black metal cylinder that Brigid had come to retrieve. When Kane managed to get his gun pointed at her, Cloudsinger had immediately slipped back into the dreaming. She stood there now, catching her breath as the wind blew across the empty plain. She smiled as she heard the sweet song of the bull roarer, beyond sight but still audible, the promise of dream slicing reassuring her. This field mission was proving more of a challenge than she had expected. Though rudimentary in his strategy, the quick-thinking Cerberus man was a worthy opponent. Each time she returned to face him in the room of skeletons, he had seemingly learned more, analyzed the strategies that she and Rockstreaming were using. The very fact that he had knocked Rockstreaming unconscious was proof of that. She cursed herself for hiding in the dreaming. Bad Father would brand her if he knew. He would certainly never let her go on a mission again. She turned, looking around the landscape, and noticed the other one, the dark-skinned man who was built like a bear, creeping up on her, moving silently despite his size. When he saw her looking at him, he smiled grimly and leaped forward, his hands reaching for her. She wondered why Rabbit in the Moon hadn't finished this one. Cloudsinger's pointed toes kicked up into the man's torso. Nowhere was safe, not even the dreaming. As Domi dodged another vicious yo-yo, she brought the barrel of the Detonics pistol back up. The old man just nodded, winking out of existence, and reappeared when the bullets had passed. The teenager then unleashed his yo-yo at her face like a stone, trying to knock her senseless. Suddenly, the young warrior was falling back, his throat erupting in a shower of blood. Domi was still moving. The other warrior, the one who had used the compound bow, had reappeared from his brief hiding place in the adjacent room. Domi aimed her detonics at them as the older man, the one with the lethal yo-yo, placed his tongue between his teeth. The warrior with the bow nodded in acknowledgement, turned, and ran down the corridor, away from his companions and Domi. Again, the warrior appeared to wink out of reality, the bullets passing through the air where he had been a fraction of a second earlier. Whatever these people were, they were more than human. That is, assuming that they were human at all. They moved quickly, stepping in and out of reality. It seemed an impossible task to nail them. Still, Domi had managed to hit the youngster. The key was to keep moving and keep pressing her attack. She barreled toward the old man as he flicked the yo-yo at her once again. Standing in the wasteland, shale and sand at his feet, Grant shook his head to clear the feeling of nausea that had threatened to overcome him with the woman's kick. He had no clue where he was, no idea what had happened to the corridor of the facility beneath the Caucasus Mountains. Suddenly, a person stepped onto the empty plain, close to where Grant had first appeared. It was the tattooed warrior, the one with the bow, who had somehow brought him there in the first place. Automatically, Grant flexed his wrist tendons as he raised his right hand, finger crooked. But the Sin-Eater failed to appear. Grant glanced at his hand incredulously. The non-appearance of his Sin-Eater pistol on command was utterly unexpected. But, he concluded, he would have to worry about that later. As the tattooed warrior dashed across the plain toward Grant, checking over his shoulder to see if anyone was following, Grant darted into action. Rabbit in the Moon looked up as he heard the approach of the ex-mag, and the grim smile on his face disappeared, replaced with an expression of irritation, annoyance. The huge man was upon him in a second, his massive right fist driving through the air. Standing over the warrior, Grant slapped his left palm against the man's chest and drew back his fist once again.
Where the hell are we?
Rabbit in the Moon rolled his shoulders, shifting his weight and shaking off the pressure of Grant's hand on his chest. But as he moved, Grant's fist rocketed toward his jaw.
Where am I?
Rabbit in the Moon spun out of the way as the ex-mag launched another jackhammer punch. Rabbit in the Moon turned, spinning to a standing position, his vision still popping with colored lights from Grant's first punch.
You're trapped in a dream, ignorant fool, and you'll be here forever.
Says you.
Grant lunged at the tattooed warrior, but Rabbit in the Moon's leg muscles tightened like a coiled spring, launching him high in the air. The rules were different there in the dreaming. The Cerberus man didn't stand a chance. Grant watched as his opponent flew into the sky above. His jaw dropped as he watched the man pass through the clouds that hurtled by overhead. And then he gritted his teeth and bunched his fists in preparation. The warrior didn't move like a man at all. He moved like a force of nature.
Oh, great trick, you ass. But what goes up must come down.
Grant stood there, watching the skies and waiting as the anger within him bubbled just below the surface. In the underground corridor, Domi was facing just two opponents now, and both of them were old men. The one who was spinning the noisemaker didn't even seem to care about her. He was busy concentrating on his spinning task, his other hand resting on a gnarled old walking stick. But the one who had launched the weighted razor-edged yo-yo at her, was a definite threat. As the yo-yo lashed toward her again, Domi dropped to her knees, sliding beneath its arc and arching her back to keep herself low to the floor. As the old man caught the yo-yo and brought his arm back for another attack, Domi sprung up again. Amazingly, the old guy didn't even seem to notice the shots. It was weird watching him. He moved gracefully despite his age, and his movements seemed unhurried, reminding Domi of a flowing river more than a human being. The old man unleashed the yo-yo at her. Domi shifted her weight as she saw the yo-yo's approach, but she was fractionally too late. She stumbled backward as her feet continued to run forward, flipping herself in an awkward spasm of muscles. Beneath the thick layer of the parka coat, she could feel a warm, damp patch, and she looked down to see that the coat had been torn by one of the buzzsaw-like edges of the yo-yo, and blood was oozing beneath. Domi looked up and realized, much to her own surprise, that the altercation had been a lucky one. The old man had lost control of the yo-yo when it slammed into her, and now the string was tangled. Her ruby eyes skipped over the old warrior himself, and she saw that he was detaching the string from the simple animal hide rig that held it to his hand. Still flat on her back, Domi raised her pistol, placing her foe dead center of her sights.
Tough break, old man.
But her finger never finished the action. The other one, the man who was spinning the bull roarer, slammed the base of his walking cane savagely against her wrist.
Ow!
She lost her grip on the weapon as her hand slapped against the floor. She turned to her new attacker just in time to see him point the walking stick in her face. The next thing she knew, a cloud of red dust burst out of the cane. In the dreaming, Rabbit in the Moon rocketed through the skies, descending back to the ground below. The Cerberus warrior was down there waiting for him, and as he fell, Rabbit in the Moon knocked three arrows in his bow. He watched as the Cerberus man leaped out of their paths. His instruction had been to go to the door near the end of the corridor, the one where the light originated. When the chalk-skinned girl had begun firing bullets at him, he had ducked into the dreaming as an efficient way to make the journey without getting hurt, not realizing that the Cerberus warrior he had left there might still have some fight in him, despite his disorientation. Clearly, his opponent was a strong warrior, strong and bull-headed. Rabbit in the Moon's feet met the ground, and he bent his knees fractionally just to dissipate the last of the flight energy. As soon as he landed, he was spinning, using the tungsten bow like a staff, thrusting the end of it at the Cerberus man's face. Grant crouched beneath the swinging bow, instinctively raising his right hand to protect his face. The bow glided by him, but Grant's attention was suddenly distracted. The Sin Eater was gradually unsheathing from its wrist holster, like a thing moving in slow motion. It had obeyed his instruction after all, but the rules of this world were so different that it was only now starting to find its way into his palm. Maybe it was a time thing, maybe something else. Grant deliberately dropped backward, falling to the ground on his buttocks and kicking out with both feet. The tattooed man was knocked off his feet. Grant drove himself back up, moving sideways in a crouch like a crab lunging at his enemy. In his right hand, the Sin Eater was uncoiled. Grant raised the weapon, his fist clamping around the butt as he drove it at his opponent's face. The Cerberus Warrior's left fist swung into view an instant later, coming at him like a missile. Rabbit in the Moon shook his head as his vision swam with blood, and he lashed out with arms and legs, struggling to connect a blow with his opponent. Grant's right hand drove a savage punch into his gut, but there was a solid weight there now, the barrel of a foot-long gun. Rabbit in the Moon made the decision to dream slice once more, activating the implant and stepping out of the dream. Suddenly, he was in the underground corridor again, just a few steps from the open doorway to the brightly lit office. But the pressure was still pushing against his belly, and he realized that he had brought the Cerberus man back with him to real world. Sin Eater pressed against his stomach. Dr. Djugashvili led Bridget and Yuri to a metal hatch at the back of the Death Cry. Close up, the weapon was all the more impressive. A long, cylindrical construction of black metal that was at least the size of an aircraft carrier. Yet despite the scale of the construction itself, the door was small, and Bridget had to duck to get inside. Within, the Death Cry had a similar feel to that of a submarine. A perilously low ceiling, plates of metal across the floor, and a little array of controls wrapped around two seats lit from above by a dull electric bulb in a cage that cast an orange-amber light. The whole control room was perhaps 12 feet square.
Well, here we are, Miss Baptiste.
I expected something bigger.
The functionality of the Death Cry is a two-man operation. One man steers the weapon into place, but the other primes and fires its scream. We had no need for an expansive control room or living quarters.
I just thought with its being so huge.
That is the weapon. The gun you hold has enough free space to allow you to grip it and pull the trigger. Nothing more. The rest is concerned with the mechanics of firing the bullet, storing and replenishing the ammunition, correct?
So how does this baby work?
Djugashvili gestured to the seats and Yuri took up his post at one of them.
The Death Cry unit is pointed in the direction of the enemy flying object. A space vehicle, you understand, embeds it in what we call its scream.
But what is the scream?
It is a blast of psychic matter, a physical manifestation of the most dangerous thoughts of the mind, the most dangerous nightmares. These thoughts will disrupt the brain of any living thing in their path. We experimented a little with mice, rats, chimpanzees, a prisoner once. The man, he screamed and screamed and screamed, and suddenly he was just ashes. He screamed himself to ashes. Can you believe?
We'd better be careful where we point this thing. We need to get it back to Earth, Doctor. How do we do that?
Djugashvili pointed to the free seat with a hand that no longer had distinct fingers, just wispy trails of light.
There is a pattern there, at the control panel. You see it?
Bridget took a step closer into the small room. General Sergei stood at the door behind them, his face bruised with dried blood beside his mouth and nose.
I know that I will find you here. Insurgents! Traitors!
Bridget swept the barrel of the Fedorov around, slamming its weight into the general's gun hand. Bridget brought the Fedorov to bear on him.
I'm sorry, General, but I'm done trying to reason with you.
The general brought his pistol around. But Sergei was too late. Bridget watched, revulsion welling within her as General Sergei disintegrated before her eyes. It was like watching ink dropped into water, a human body reduced to a cloud, then a mist, then after a few more seconds, just a slightly darker stain in the air that dissipated to nothingness. There were two more soldiers outside on the scaffolding, and they looked bewildered as they saw their leader disintegrate before their eyes. Bridget tossed the spent rifle aside and stepped onto the scaffolding. She drove the heel of her palm into the nose of the soldier on the right. The man stumbled backward, doubling over as he reached for the bloody smear where his nose had been an instant ago, and Bridget pulled the pistol from her holster and targeted the other soldier.
Walk away, and maybe you get to live.
I'm sorry, but my orders...
He stumbled for a moment, and she saw the familiar, horrifying mist that was his body begin to burn away from his form. She pointed the gun at the soldier with the caved-in nose as he struggled to a standing position.
You want me to do you too?
The soldier shook his head, wincing at the pain in his nose. Then he turned and made his way toward the ladder that led back down to the floor, as his colleague continued to evaporate at Bridget's feet. When she was sure that he had left, Bridget returned to the control room. The room had taken a few hits from the general's final attack, and one of the control panels was sparking where a bullet had ripped through a plastic-covered display. Djougashvili lay slumped on the floor, his arms and legs gone, his chest and the remnants of his face disappearing into mist. Bridget knelt before him, her emerald eyes locking with his.
Doctor, I'm so sorry.
I thought I had longer, but the general shot must
have... It doesn't matter now. Thank you, Dr. Djougashvili. Thank you for your help. Thank you for maybe saving the human race with what you did here today. I'm so sorry that you never
Don't
got to see...
Don't be sorry. It's not so bad, this death. I remember the feeling now. Something I had forgotten for so long.
Bridget reached to touch his cheek, but her hand passed through it, the man's face turning to a cloud of dust.
Doctor?
It is like being born, Bridget.
As he nodded, his head turned to nothingness, and he ceased to exist. Bridget turned away. Dr. Djougashvili was gone. As she knelt there, willing herself to focus on the mission at hand, something caught her eye, a shining speck on her finger. Bringing her hand close, she saw a tiny trickle of water running along her index finger, where she had passed her hand through Djougashvili's cheek. A single human tear. Alone in the bunk room, Kane bent to study the still form of his defeated foe. The man was covered in tattoos, swirling tribal markings with sharp right-angled turns, like the lines on a circuit board. The man had used twin metal boomerangs, razor-sharp along their edges. Kane realized that this foe had been employing some sort of matter transfer device, adding an inhuman swiftness to his movements, creating an almost devastating attack. And the girl had done the same. But Kane had experience with matter transfer, and he knew that what you held tended to travel with you. He stood and placed his foot on the man's undershirt, pressing his weight against the man's chest and rocking his foe just a little. As Kane watched, the man's head started to shake, and Kane saw that he was about to wake up.
Let's see you jump out of this, you slimy eel.
Kane held the nose of the Sin Eater at the man's face. The man's eyes popped open and saw the Sin Eater pointed between them. He glanced up and his eyes met Kane's.
What say me and you have a little talk?
Rockstreaming glared contemptuously at Kane in silence, so Kane pushed a little harder on his chest.
I'm trying to help us both out here, brother.
Then you're a fool, Cerberus man.
My name's Kane. What's yours?
My warrior name is Rockstreaming.
Kane turned as he saw the woman in the white strips appearing to his left. Grant's free hand was reaching up toward Rabbit and the Moon's neck, grabbing for the torn streamers of his tattered blue-green jacket. But Rabbit and the Moon closed his eyes as he fell backward like so much dead weight. He dropped out of reach of the grasping hand, and in the same instant faded back into the dreaming, as he listened for the song of Goodfather's spinning bull roarer. He was in the dreaming as his body hit the floor. He had evaded the grip of the Cerberus man. He was alone once more. Lying in the dirt, Rabbit and the Moon dropped the bow and reached for the belly wound with his right hand. It burned like wildfire, and when he touched his gut, he found a gore-smeared hole just above his left hip. He closed his eyes, feeling for the bullets. There was a trick to this. Badfather had showed it to him once when the older man had accidentally got a knife embedded in his arm during a hunt. That time, Badfather had leaped quickly into the dreaming before yanking the blade out. His will had stemmed the blood flow, and he had reappeared in real world with nothing more than dried blood to show where the knife had been, no wound beneath its smear. The whole operation had taken maybe 30 seconds, and Rabbit in the Moon had been in awe of the older man's abilities and quick thinking. He reached into the hole in his body and felt around for the bullets, snatching three of the metal invaders. The others had to have passed clean through him. He couldn't feel them as he pushed thumb and forefinger into the wound in his small intestine. His eyes still closed, his teeth clenched against the urge to scream, Rabbit in the Moon removed his fingers from inside his body and willed the wound to heal the same way he had willed the burn to heal during the multiplane practice battle with Cloudsinger. His flesh and all that was below re-knitted, and suddenly he was whole again. He lay in the dirt as he felt the burning subside. Back in the underground bunker, Grant recovered his balance and blinked away irritation as the tattooed warrior disappeared in front of him. These tricky bastards kept pulling the same stunt on him, but there was no way they could keep it up forever. He had wounded the man armed with the bow. His fists had connected with the bone and muscle of the man's face, and bullets from the Sin Eater had definitely caught the guy. Grant looked around, assessing his location. He was back in the Project Chernobog bunker, almost two-thirds of the way down the corridor from where he had entered. He stalked forward in the darkness, keeping his body low, and reached the open door to the Cheka KGB office, glancing warily inside. Brigid still sat there, cross-legged, her eyes closed. He could see where Kane had patched up the cuts on her face, antiseptic patches taped to her left cheek and the cut above her eye. There was swelling around her mouth, and he could see the shining skin where she would have a black eye before the day's end. But she looked pretty much okay. Grant ducked into the office, swinging the Sin Eater around as he confirmed that no one was waiting for him. Other than Brigid's static figure, the small, low-ceilinged office was empty. Grant walked across to her, looking closely, checking that she was still breathing. He activated his contact.
Kane, I'm with Brigid in the office. You read me?
I'm in the bunk room, but I'm a little busy here with some warrior chick. How's Baptiste?
She looks fine.
Great. Think you can spare a moment?
I'm on my way.
Struggling to free himself from beneath Kane's heavy foot, Rock Streaming saw Cloudsinger's blurring, swift attack. But suddenly, the skull of one of the long-dead occupants of the room flew at her, hooked and propelled by the end of Kane's gun. The impact not only disrupted Cloudsinger's aim, but it also knocked her hard enough that she toppled to the floor. Rock Streaming closed his eyes and activated the implant, slipping into the dreaming for a fraction of a second before leaping out again into real world. He was outside. His dream slice had taken him just 15 feet upward, back to the surface of the mountain pass. Rock Streaming opened his eyes and saw the Cerberus warrior, Kane, still standing over him, Toad just pressing lightly on his chest, a wicked smile on his lips as he whipped his gun back into Rock Streaming's face. Without warning, something heavy and fast smashed into Grant's back as he stepped to the doorway. He looked over his shoulder and saw that the tattooed bowman with the shabby blue-green coat was standing over him, having reappeared from nowhere. Grant's eyes were drawn to the man's belly, and he saw the unmistakable blot of red where he'd shot the man.
I shot you!
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Brigid dropped into the seat beside Yuri as he explained the basic controls of the Death Cry.
I have the piloting and weapons controls for the Death Cry.
Brigid saw that his hands had been enveloped by twin sphincters in the console, like operating a hazcam or radiation box.
But I require you to bring us into the corporeal world.
No problem. What button do I press?
No buttons, I'm afraid. You see the pattern on the grid in front of you.
A backlit screen came to life before Brigid's eyes.
You are now the launch mechanism. You understand?
She looked at the backlit screen. The pattern was an intricate swirl of blues and greens, with flecks of red and green scattered within it. A mandala, Brigid realized, similar to the one that had drawn her there.
You want me to concentrate?
You are the launch mechanism, Brigid Baptiste.
A red light flicked on above his head, dull in the orange lighting of the cabin.
I think you had better hurry.
Company?
It seems that the other soldiers have come back from their little jaunt.
The pattern of the mandala was intricate, but Brigid had almost memorized it already, her eidetic memory coming into play once again.
Yuri, what happens when we get back to the real world? I mean, it's 300 years since you had a body to return to.
I would rather not think about it. I believe in your supra-terrestrial threat, Miss Brigid. I believe in the Anunnaki. And whether I am with you or not, I believe that the Death Cry will provide your ultimate salvation.
Brigid began to sink into the depths of her meditation.
Besides, what do I have left to live for here?
In the vast, white-walled room of the Astral Factory, the remaining Russian soldiers and technicians watched in amazement as the great bulk of the Death Cry shimmered before their eyes, as though viewed through a heat haze, more liquid than solid. Two of the soldiers raised their Fedorov rifles. They were expected to protect it, and now it seemed that it was being stolen. Better that it be destroyed than fall into enemy hands, they decided. Their bullets cut through the air, but the death cry was gone. Only the scaffolding that had been built around its enormous shell remained. Lying in the soil and grass, Rock Streaming thrust up both hands and wrestled the muzzle of Kane's Sin Eater aside as he flipped his body like a fish trapped on dry land. Kane staggered, his toe leaving the warrior's chest for a moment, and he stamped his boot down under the man's leg lest he lose him again. Suddenly, he was thrown from Rock Streaming, who had somehow used his grip on the barrel of the Sin Eater as a fulcrum. For a fraction of a second, Kane thought that he had blacked out, but he hadn't. The blackness that encroached on his vision was a shadow, a colossal shadow of incredible magnitude, blotting out the sun in the sky above. Rock Streaming stopped to look overhead in awe at the massive object that filled the sky. It was incredible, almost too large to comprehend. A giant black cylinder with irregular bumps and protrusions along its vast length. It shuddered for a moment, 50 feet above them, stretching between the mountain peaks, somehow unreal, its image doubling and tripling until it finally manifested in its full, solid glory. The death cry had arrived. Bridget's eyes swam in and out of focus, the lit pane of glass that showed the mandala blurring and reforming for a few moments. She looked across to Yuri in the seat beside her and saw the glazed and terrified look in his eyes.
Did we make it? Yuri, did we make it?
We made it.
The whole scene, the control room of the Death Cry, Yuri, the mandala, they were fading away, indistinct as passing clouds or memories of dreams. She was racing through the air then, weightless, like a wraith. She saw the mountains, Kane and another man looking up at her, at the looming shadow above. She was falling, plummeting through the air. The grass came closer, the soil, the rocks. Bridget saw the room. The little gray-walled box with the brass Cheka shield on the wall, the furniture pushed to one end, the carpet hanging from the pitons that Grant had hammered into the ceiling. And there, in the middle of the room, legs crossed and eyes closed, was a woman with red-gold hair and the trim, hungry build of a racehorse. The woman was familiar, like a face in the mirror, but inverted. And there were two other people in the room, close to the open door. A man that Bridget didn't recognize was standing over Grant's fallen body, swinging a vicious kick at her colleague's face. The stranger was dressed in a shabby jacket, all strands of green and blue, and he wore a cylinder across his back. As Bridget watched, floating overhead, weightless, the man reached into the cylinder and whipped out a thin shaft of metal with a sharpened triangle at its end, an arrow. He drew back his hand in preparation to stab the helpless form of Grant through the eye, moving with savage determination. There was a blur of incredible movement then, as Bridget's astral form dived back into her physical body, sitting cross-legged on the floor. Just as Rabbit in the Moon brought the arrow down at the Cerberus warrior on the floor of the office, something hit him in the side, and a woman's hand grasped his wrist, halting the arrow's movement. Rabbit in the Moon looked around as he faltered toward the wall. The woman, the redhead, who had been unconscious in the center of the little office, was awake, clutching his wrist with incredible strength, cold determination in her fierce green eyes. Her other hand swung around, connecting solidly with Rabbit in the Moon's jaw. His right eye turned once more red with blood. The woman had stepped away from him, and he watched, unable to make his muscles move quickly enough as she swung one of her long legs at him, kicking him hard in the jaw on the exact same spot that her punch had connected. He lay on the floor, watching as the woman turned her back on him and walked away toward the far wall. She knelt on the desk that sat flush with the wall and reached up for something that was hanging there. When she turned back, Rabbit in the Moon saw that she was holding a thick chunk of forged metal, a brass-colored plaque of some type, shaped like a shield. The way she held it made it clear that the shield was heavy. As the woman swung the hunk of metal at his head, Rabbit in the Moon dream-sliced out of real world, back to the dreaming. A few steps across from her, Grant was wiping blood from his face as he struggled to get up off the floor.
Thanks for that, Bridget. You couldn't have timed it better.
Oh, you could have taken him. I just thought I'd give you a hand.
Bridget suddenly sagged to the floor.
You okay?
I'm fine. My legs just... How long have I been sitting there like that?
19, 20 hours, give or take.
Any idea where Tattoo Boy disappeared to?
Some kind of personal mat trance.
When all of this is done, I'm gonna have to look into that.
Grant hurried after her, his face spattered with blood.
Where are we going?
I came back with the weapon, the death cry. It's outside.
Well, nice job.
Then he stopped and turned back toward the lower end of the corridor.
What is it? Where are you going?
Kane's back there.
No, he's not. I saw him outside while I was flying through the astral plane.
Grant looked quizzically at Bridget for a moment.
Do I need to understand what the hell you just said?
No. Let's go.
With that, Grant and Bridget raced along the sloped corridor toward the strange sound that was coming from its highest end. Everyone in the Cerberus Ops Center stopped and stared at the satellite feed that was transmitting live from the Caucasus Mountains.
What the heck?
The huge black cylinder appeared from nowhere, cutting across the image like a thick vertical stripe. In two strides, Lakesh was at his shoulder, and Donald Bry, Mariah Falk, Skylar Hitch, and other members of the operating crew soon joined them, staring at the incredible construction that hovered between the mountains.
What is it?
It just appeared out of nowhere.
Lakesh was already standing at the communications terminal, adjusting the controls and slipping a headset over his ear.
This is Cerberus, calling Kane and Grant. Please respond.
In the shadow of the death cry, Rock streaming threw his third successive punch at Kane. But Kane held his ground, slapping the blow aside. He had the man's measure. The warrior favored his right when he attacked, and Kane just had to time his defense while the tattooed man exhausted himself.
This is Cerberus, calling Kane and Grant. Please respond.
Kane launched a left hook at the warrior before him.
This is Kane, Cerberus. I'm mixed up in something just now.
Rock streaming dropped before him, trying for a leg sweep, and Kane leaped over it.
Our feed is back up and running, but we have a large UFO showing right above you, hovering over the mountains.
I'm outside.
Kane moved backward to the strip of blacktop, putting a little distance between himself and his attacker.
I see it.
Lakesh, Kane, Bridget here. What you're seeing is the death cry. Back with me.
Good work. How are you feeling, Bridget?
Rock streaming swung a high kick at Kane's head, and Kane weaved on the spot to avoid it.
People, we have more immediate problems, namely a group of crazy tribal warrior types who seem to be able to disappear during battle. It's really hacking me off.
And suddenly, Rock streaming winked out of existence again.
Damn it!
Scans show a local field similar to a Matrans, but utilizing some different sequencing.
That's great, Lakesh. How do we stop it? Any ideas?
We'll start examining straight away, Kane. Stand by.
One of them has just appeared. Oh no, make that three.
The data's just coming through now, Kane.
Grant and Bridget had sprinted to the far end of the corridor, where the exit to the facility was located. Through the night lenses, they could see two figures waiting at the end. But as they reached them, two old, bearded men in ragged clothes, a third man winked into existence. Bridget recognized the tattoos on the man's coffee-colored skin, very similar in style to the man she had pounced upon in the office a few moments ago, the one who had been attacking Grant.
Is there a whole army of these creeps?
Bridget reached for her TP-9 pistol, a reassuringly solid weight at her hip once more. Grant raised the Sin Eater toward the strangers, ready to unleash a deadly attack. But before he had the chance, the group of three disappeared.
Crap!
Bridget rushed across to a room at the right, and Grant saw a pair of booted feet sticking out from the open doorway. It was Domi. When Grant reached them, he saw Domi lying flat on her back, her legs curled in the fetal position, hands clutched to her face. Bridget was on her knees beside the chalk-skinned woman.
Domi, what happened?
Domi's been hit, look!
Grant leaned closer. There was no blood, no signs of a wound, but the parts of her face that were visible around her hands looked stained.
Domi, it's Grant. What happened here?
Asshole had some kind of spray in his walking stick. Got me full in the face. Burns like hell.
Think you can move? Because if not, we're going to have to go on without you. Kane needs us.
Domi's hands moved away from her face at last, and Grant saw what looked like a splash of paint across her eyes, nose, and mouth. Beneath the dark lenses, her eyes were streaming with tears.
Go ahead, and I'll catch up. And if you see that old bastard, break both his legs to make sure he needs that walking stick for me, okay?
Grant nodded solemnly and led the way down the corridor toward the broken vent, Bridget just behind him. A little farther along the corridor, they found the young man, thin and reedy, who had whipped Grant's copperhead subgun from his hands. The man was lying in a pool of his own blood, his head lolling at an unhealthy angle, and the majority of his throat destroyed by a single bullet.
Looks like she got a few hits in before they got her.
Inside the control hub of the death cry, Yuri's hands rushed across the hidden controls, watching the warning light blink on again, off again, in that slow, repetitive manner that Russian technology favored. It gave the impression that the alarm was not urgent, but he knew it was. He glanced up at the dials above him, watching the counter trip over to zero. Yuri could guess what had happened. A stray bullet from General Sergei's gun had to have damaged the controls of the firing mechanism. The death cry had been set on an irreversible countdown to unleash the scream. and Brigid, the beautiful woman from the future, had disappeared, called back to her own body as soon as she had entered the physical plane. Yet Yuri had not. No body to go to, he realized. He was in the future. Against all expectations, he had actually achieved some kind of immortality, or at least longevity, from his time in the Astral Factory. Only to have it snatched away from him with the Death Cry's final shout, unless somehow he could stop it. The Death Cry was designed as a doomsday device. The whole system could be run by two people for the simple reason that everyone on board would die in its incredible blast. But surely, Yuri's brain told him, there must be a way to stop it.
There must be a way.
Kane's head whipped around as his foe reappeared 20 feet away from him along the tarmac strip. Rock Streaming was then joined by two other men, both of them quite old as far as Kane could judge. The one to the left was spinning an Aborigine bull roarer over his head. The sound was familiar. It was the penetrating groan that Kane had first heard in the underground burrow when the strangers had appeared. To his side, the other man was holding what looked like a blade, but Kane knew now that it was a metal boomerang. Kane watched for a moment as Rock Streaming pointed at the Death Cry hovering above them, and the two men nodded. The Sin Eater hung in his hand, and he wondered what his chances were of hitting all three of them before they disappeared. As he considered this, Lakesh came over the contact once more.
Kane, we've isolated the Matrans device that your enemies are accessing.
Can you switch it off?
No can do, Kane. We can't access the specific Matrans they're utilizing from here, but maybe you can shut it down at your end. The device travels with them, generating a specific frequency that allows them to step in and out of gateways. Do you see anything obvious that might contain this generator? A box, perhaps? Or maybe a radio device of some sort?
Something generating a frequency, you say? Like a loud note? Something like that?
It may be outside of the range of human hearing, Kane. You might not be able to detect it by sound alone.
Oh, I've detected it.
Kane kicked away from the ground and moved into a fluid sprint across the grass and onto the cracked blacktop of the little road, rushing toward the three warriors.
Sly son of a bitch had it in his hand the whole damn time!
The two field leaders saw the huge black shape that dominated the sky, and Goodfather nodded his approval as he spun the bull roarer overhead.
Badfather! It's here!
We take it!
Badfather stepped back into the dreaming for a fraction of a second, Rock Streaming at his side. The two men reappeared in real world atop the Death Cry, 80 feet in the air. It was glowing now, a cascade of colors rippling over its surface, and the men could feel the thrumming of its power through the soles of their feet. Balancing with ease on the vast curved shell of the weapon, Badfather crouched and placed both hands against the device. He looked up at Rock Streaming, encouraging the young man to join him. Rock Streaming crouched beside his mentor, placing the palms of both hands against the skin of the massive weapon as colors streamed brighter and brighter across it. He looked up at Badfather, and the old man nodded once, solemnly.
It's ours!
Badfather and Rock Streaming activated their implants, preparing to slice into the dream world once again. Two of the warriors had winked out of existence, leaving only an old man and the bull roarer spinning through the air above his head. As Kane sprinted across the cracked tarmac toward Goodfather, he kicked off, leaping high. Still spinning the bull roarer, the old man turned in time to see the mighty figure of the Cerberus man barreling toward him from overhead. Yeah! Kane's left arm drew back, then his fist rushed forward toward the old man's face below. The bull roarer whipped around his wrist and up his arm. Then, as the bull roarer circled his arm, tightening around it, Kane swung his fist toward the old man's jaw. Aboard the Death Cry, Yuri stopped struggling within the safety gloves to right the controls. The whole of its great length was shaking, ready to unleash its terrifying banshee wail. In his head, Yuri cursed General Sergei's foolishness, firing shots in the enclosed area like that. Sitting there, within the unit, he could feel the scream building. Reluctantly, fearfully, Yuri closed his eyes.
I'm sorry, Brigid.
The Death Cry built to a crescendo, and the scream shattered the world about him, tearing him apart. Grant pulled himself over the lip of the ventilation grill and climbed out to the surface above with Brigid behind. As he stood there, he saw the glowing object in the sky, as huge and bright as a full moon, shaking as it emitted a beam of sheer brilliance from its coned front end.
Grant, look away!
But he didn't need to. The whole incredibly proportioned cylinder, along with its devastating bright scream, winked from existence, leaving a vacuum of imploding air in its absence. Air rushed to fill the void, and branches, leaves, rocks, and birds were sucked upward toward the space that the death cry had occupied a moment before. Goodfather fell backward as Kane's left fist slammed into his jaw with piledriver force. The bull roarer in his hand was tugged away by momentum, ripped out of his hand as it whipped around Kane's arm. The older man tried to focus on the implant, urging it to dream slice once again. Above Goodfather, the cord of the bull roarer tightened around Kane's outstretched arm, cutting through the sleeve of his jacket and cinching into the corded muscles beneath. Legs cycling through the air, he felt himself dragged upward into the vacuum that had suddenly replaced the death cry. Then he began to fall earthward once again, and his right foot suddenly connected with the ground. The silenced bull roarer was wrapped around the whole length of his left arm, and blood was oozing around the device's cord, seeping into the torn sleeve of his jacket. Kane's head rested on his outstretched right arm, his teeth gritted against the pain of the wrapped cord on his left, his legs a tangle behind him. He lay there, unwilling to move, excruciating pain racking his left arm, and felt the early morning sun beating down on his back. The shadow in the sky, the death cry, was gone. His body crying in pain, rabid in the moon, lay on the sandy plateau of the dreaming. His face was ruined. The woman's savage blows had deadened nerves, and at least three of his teeth felt loose when he probed them with his tongue. The vision in his right eye was obscured with a red wash, and his left eye kept trying to close. Down in his belly, Rabbit in the Moon could feel where the gunshot wound had reopened. He had moved too quickly, the recovery incomplete, undoing the miracle that had saved him. He lay there, ignoring the aching sensations from every part of his battered frame. He told himself that he was safe in the dreaming. He opened his good eye once more, looking across the plain. The old man approached him. Goodfather had dream sliced, but his neck was crooked, and there was a swelling on the right side of his jaw. The old man stumbled, falling to his knees.
Goodfather?
Then he saw the other thing, behind Goodfather. It was incredibly large, looming in the sky, awash with colors, and Badfather and Rabbit in the Moon's blood brother, Rock Streaming, were crouched on its shell. With all those colors running through, it looked so pretty. And as an impossible pain wrenched apart the very fabric of the dreaming, Rabbit in the Moon's body was ripped to shreds. Kane tried to lift himself from the ground, forcing his muscles to move. He saw Bridget and Grant approaching him from the direction of the broken ventilation grill. Both of them were armed, checking the area for hostiles.
What did you do to yourself this time, Kane?
Can you get this thing off me? I can't feel my damn arm.
Okay, just sit still. You look like a bear caught in a trap.
She leaned close to him, and Kane examined the patches of antiseptic weave that he had taped to her face as she carefully unwound the bull roarer from his arm.
The weapon. The death cry. It was here, but it's gone now.
We saw it start to glow, to spit something, and it just disappeared.
It went off. I don't know why, but the death cry activated. It was about to blow when it disappeared, caught up in some kind of dimensional jump. Maybe Yuri sent it back to the factory.
It wasn't a dimension jump, Baptiste. They were trying to hijack it, take it with them. But I cut the matrans they were using at the last second.
So where are they?
Grant looked around the deserted clearing that surrounded the road. The three of them were alone. Even the old man who had swung the bull roarer was gone. His left arm numb, Kane closed his eyes, feeling the weight of exhaustion come over him.
Contact Cerberus. Maybe Lakesh can track them now that his equipment is up and running.
30 hours had passed since the field team had returned from Georgia to the Cerberus Redoubt in the Bitterroot Mountains, and a rich orange sun was resting low on the horizon as it slowly set. Lakesh found Bridget out on the plateau by the redoubt's main doors, sitting alone on the ground with her legs stretched out before her, watching the sun making its languid descent.
Are you all right, Bridget?
She turned and showed him her open, warm smile. There were several adhesive strips across her face, and her left eye still held a distinct bruise. But she looked healthy, all things considered.
I'm fine. Just thinking about everything that happened back there.
Lakesh sat down next to her.
In Georgia.
Georgia and the Astral Factory in Krylograt. You know those poor people are still stuck in there, living their lives in that hidden recess in the human mind, ignorant of time's passage.
But there's no weapon for them to work on anymore.
I didn't have time to check every room of the facility. Maybe they had the Death Cry Mark II tucked in the next room over.
Or maybe they'll stop building arms and try to create something of their situation. Another world, a whole new society.
With 10 soldiers and a handful of lab technicians? You have the heart of a poet, Lakesh. How's Domi?
I left her in bed asleep. Reba gave her some lotion for her face, a mixture of lavender oil and chamomile. It eases the burning sensation, which Reba assures me will pass of its own accord in a few days. In the meantime, Domi is behaving like a caged lion who can't wait to get back out into the world, of course.
Of course.
Ah, she was lucky. The night vision lenses had protected her from the worst of the hot powder. It was the only thing that saved her eyesight. Well, I should be getting back to the op center to check on things.
Maybe I'll pop in a little later, help you find somewhere for the new rug.
There's no rush. You've earned a break. All four of you. Lakesh started back toward the entrance to the redoubt.
Lakesh?
Yes, dearest Bridget.
Have you heard anything about Kane?
He came out of surgery a couple of hours ago. I thought you knew. There was some nerve damage to his arm, but Reba repaired it. He'll be fine in a few days. 100%. Bridget stood, brushing soil from her backside as she jogged over to join Lakesh at the doors. You're really not needed in the ops center, Bridget.
I'm not coming with you. I'm going to find Kane and see if he wants to arm wrestle. Opportunities like this don't come along every day.
The two of them entered the redoubt together. In a broken air vent, in a bunker hidden beneath the Caucasus Mountains, a woman dressed in strips of material was waking up. Almost 2 days before, when she had awakened to find herself beaten and bloody on the floor of the bunk room, Cloudsinger had immediately engaged the implant at the base of her neck and tried to dream slice. But to her horror, nothing had happened. No jump, no transferal, nothing. She had strained her ears, listening for a trace of the singing bull roarer, its promising salvation, but all had been silent. Then, as she listened, she had heard voices. People in the underground complex, walking along the corridor, and the beam of their flashlights danced in the open doorway. She had moved quickly, despite the pain from all over her body, clambering into the broken vent on the wall of the bunk room, the one that Kane had shot to pieces. Inside, she had hidden herself from sight while the enemy went about their cleanup operation, sweeping the bunker for stragglers, but failing to find her. And she had tried periodically to dream slice, to step out of real world and into the dreaming, but nothing happened. Tucked there in the absolute darkness, beside the room full of skeletons, she had slowed her breathing and willed herself into a healing coma, her heart beating at an eighth of its usual pace. Almost 2 days later, conscious once more, she found herself alone. Cloudsinger blinked, bringing her electrochemical polymer lenses to life on the nictitating membranes that slotted over her eyes, granting her night vision in the pitch-dark bunker. She walked from the bunk room, checking each doorway in turn, confirming her suspicion that she was totally alone in the complex. Alone except for the corpse of Neverwalk, a bloody ruin where his neck had been. With none of her strike team left, no access to the dreaming, Cloudsinger was utterly alone. Alone, but alive.
Outlander's Death Cry is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2008, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, David Coyne, James Konacek, Margie Tompros, Andy Clements, Michael John Casey, Lily Beacon, Michael Glenn, Casey Platt, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Joe Brack, Dylan Lynch, and Peter Stray. Additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Greg Reinfeld. Graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld and Brian Rogers. Adapted for graphic audio by Joshua Cristiano. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. Additional original music by Chris Rowan and Dan Smith. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Scratch Morton and Bo Creel, two aging cowpokes and friends for years, have seen their share of cattle drives, shootouts, and bust-ups. They do their best to stay on the right side of the law and never go looking for trouble, but it seems to find them just the same.
That sounds like trouble. We taking cards in this game?
I reckon. Since we don't know the details, might be better if we tried not to kill anybody.
In Arizona, they get stuck in the midst of a battle between competing stagecoach lines. Of course, a pretty woman who happens to own one of the lines has a lot to do with it, and things aren't quite what they seem.
Gil told us about how Rance Judson and his gang have been running roughshod over this part of the territory for a while.
There's a man named Jared Rutledge who has a freight line that runs between Red Butte, Chino Valley, and Cottonwood. As it turns out, Mr. Rutledge planned to begin running stagecoaches in addition to his freight wagons, but our arrival here ruined that for him.
I know you think that I'm somehow to blame for Abigail's troubles, but I'm not. I can see the writing on the wall, though. The Sutherland stage line is doomed, and if you stay there, you'll go down with it.
You think Dave's trying to hunt down those outlaws?
I think Dave is meeting those outlaws.
What? You're saying that he's one of the gang?
It would explain some things.
This is gonna just about kill his ma.
That's why we're not gonna tell her.
Seems like trouble's been coming at us from all sides.
William W. Johnstone's Sidewinders.
Well, good luck, fellas. I got a feeling you'll be needing it.
Yeah, we always need luck.
Yeah, but this time you'll be heading straight into the lion's den, just like that fella in the Bible.
You mean Daniel?
No, I'm talking about the fella who went in there before Daniel, the one you ain't never heard of, because he got plumb ate up.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.